Cyber physical systems technology is a relatively new field that researchers say will transform the way people interact with engineered systems in the same way the internet has transformed the way people interact with information. The development of this technology is also important for the national and economic security of the United States. Charles Toll is among those researching cyber physical systems. Dr. Toll is an associate professor at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology and senior researcher at the Idaho National Laboratory. He and his teammates were recently recognized with a Special Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers Award for leadership in the development and advancement of research in the field of resilient cyber physical systems. And he joins us from our studios at the Dahl Art Center in Rapid City. And Dr. Toll, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, first of all, we're getting into a field that is unfamiliar with to a lot of people, including myself. So first of all, what is a cyber physical system?
Well, it's arrived at, or we started talking about this about 6 or 7 years ago when I was at the Idaho National Lab. And we are basically a group of, we're part of what's called the ISIS signature, the Instrumentation Control and Intelligence Systems signature at the Idaho National Lab. And there we bring together a whole bunch of different types of researchers to look at control systems. And one of the things that the Idaho National Lab is very interested in, because it's a Department of Energy research lab, is the security of our power grid and our power systems, and in general, all kinds of big systems. When we think about chemical plants in this country, we can think of bad situations going on in those chemical plants. The Idaho National Lab is in charge of all of the nuclear reactor development in the country and is the lead lab for nuclear development. So these kinds of systems and big infrastructure is of great interest to the Idaho National Lab, and securing those systems is of great interest. So because of that, we know that humans, traditionally in controls, we have dealt with, you know, the mathematics of the system by itself and not thinking about humans in that loop. And as we come forward, we're very interested in the human interaction, and we're interested in not just system failures, but attacks that can occur in those systems. So traditional control theory doesn't deal with those issues. So we need to bring into the next generation version of control theory, how do we deal with people, adversaries, actively trying to destabilize and damage our systems and our critical infrastructure?
And that's what this is what the award was for, this field of research.
Yes, it didn't exist about 7 years ago, and we started looking into it, trying to bring together the different disciplines. Resilience Week is like, I forget exactly which one it is. It's been around a number of times. I think it's like the 5th or 6th Resilience Week. We'll start 2 weeks from now in Denver. It's an international conference that we started out of the Idaho National Lab to start to bring together these very, very diverse research groups to bring the what everybody knows as the cyber hackers together with the control systems people. And they talk very different languages, and then to throw in the mix the people that worry about humanity and the and all of the human systems, and bringing those people together makes a very, very interesting dynamic, because none of those three groups tend to speak the same language. So it is a difficult activity to start to form a new research field where we fuse these different talents and these different ideas together to bring about a new generation of control systems.
So how do you talk with each other then, since, as you mentioned, there's different languages going on, different understandings. Is there like a common reference point that you all begin with?
Well, that's what we're working on. That's why we started the Resilience Conference. It has caught on. There are more resilient activities going on in the country. Some of the big universities have gotten very interested in this, and they have competing research groups, and that's one of the reasons why we're pushing it along. And we don't have those answers yet. I mean, we're just now starting to get to know each other and starting to learn each other's fields and going and listening to other people talk, so that we can start to learn the other language, so that we can start to translate from from our perspective to their perspective and start to try to work on those benchmarks and those test cases about how to discuss these problems and how should we fuse the different technologies to produce a successful new framework.
If you don't have the answers, you're looking for the answers, are there certain questions that that you're starting out with?
Well, we know some questions because we know that we've seen control systems now being attacked by cyber bugs, and those have been done well. We know that people are hacking into our financial systems. So, I mean, we don't really know all the right questions yet, and we don't even know exactly how to form the right paradigm of what we're chasing. But we do have examples in other systems where we see these kinds of things occurring, cyber attacks and how humans interact with systems. I mean, almost all of the major engineering disasters are generally formed from human error, not from machine error. And because of that, we know that we need to bring those kinds of ideas into the development of the control systems. So, no, we don't know all the questions yet, but that's part of bringing people together generates new questions. You know, we come with a predisposed set of questions from our own fields, but then by listening and talking to each other, we can generate more questions and start to refine where we're going and what we really need to do.
When you talk about resilient cyber physical systems, the resiliency that's developing cyber physical systems that are immune to these cyber attacks, or at least it can withstand cyber attacks?
Well, that's one of the reasons why there's been a long history of doing different kinds of control theory. There's like robust control, and there's adaptive control, and there's all these different types of words that have been used to develop control systems that are, we'll call it robust, that can react to certain kinds of attacks or certain kind, not really attacks, but certain kind of failures. We needed a new word to say that we don't want to just survive a system failure. We need, and we don't want to just survive a cyber failure. We don't want to just block. What we need is something that can be graceful, meaning if problems in the system or cyber problems occur or somebody takes down an asset in a control system, how can it more than just adapt, more than just change its control laws, how can it, if it's going to fail gracefully, meaning that we can bring it back up when it's done, we can take it down gracefully, we can, not like today when the blackouts occur, everything drops, and it takes hours and hours and days sometimes to bring these assets back online. When we talk about resilience, we talk about not just being able to continue operation in a degraded state, but we're also talking about being able to take systems down in a graceful state and be able to bring those systems back up in a graceful state in a very fast hurry. So it's a much more encompassing, much larger effort than what has been done in the past. So resilience is really resilience, like the human spirit is resilient. We can have all kinds of horrible things happen to us, and yet children can still play and still laugh, even when they're in the Middle East today.
Is this a situation where you have to go back with the old technologies, and we talk about blackouts and that sort of thing, the grid, and trying to fix the old grid, for example, or are you trying to create new systems that are more able to withstand cyber attacks and other problems?
Well, this is what my students hate. When you ask a question like that, I'll say yes.
So
you can't work in a vacuum. We can't wave a magic wand and have a new system deployed instantly. So the answer to your question is yes. We have to work with old systems. Yes, we have to work with old technologies. How do we take those old systems, those old technologies, how do they weave them into the fabric of a new system that's now trying to be designed and come out of the old system. So you can't do it without touching the old system, and there's transitions that go on, you know, and you have to develop the new system that's much more robust. And then how do you do that? How do you have old technology that can't do certain things? How do you add technology to it to make it resilient and to make it work in the new framework? Those are some of the major issues that we're facing.
Is this pretty much the way, you know, throughout the history, particularly more modern history, say over the past 100 years or so, that this is the way things naturally develop anyway, that you're dealing with old technology as you're developing the new technology and new systems?
Well, not always. I mean, there's a lot of new technology that comes online. I mean, if you think about, there is some level of old technology and new technology, but a lot of times the new technologies can just spawn themselves in somewhat of a separate way. I mean, if you think about the old phone system, it's very different than the cable system, which is very different than the fiber optic networks that are being put in place for the superhighways, which is different than the cellular networks, which are really kind of autonomous in a lot of ways from the traditional hardline system. So they can be tied together, and they can't be sometimes. So it depends on the type of system. Not everything evolves this way.
Well, looking at, you know, there's always these horror stories and stories of doom for the future. How complex is this challenge of fighting cybersecurity threats and developing these resilient systems?
It is a large challenge. It's a lot of people. It's kind of interesting. When I was at the National Lab, you talk to researchers and you talk to university professors, and they get this idea that the National Labs just have this money and they just, you know, choose a topic and then they attack the topic. That's not how it goes. National Labs are not much different than university professors. They don't do anything unless they get funding for it. And they go through peer review processes to do that. And you have to find a governmental program that's willing to support new ideas. And of course, they are very, because of how the government works, they're very careful about going into fields that don't exist and betting on things they don't know will deliver results, like everybody, right? Everybody needs to have a good review at the end of the day so that we can get our raises and we can, you know, go on with our lives and keep our jobs. So a lot of effort has gone into, you know, educating. It took time for us to put together the Resilience Week. It's taken time to educate governmental agencies about why this is important. It takes time to coordinate between governmental agencies, and all that kind of work goes on long before money starts flowing. The one advantage that national labs have is they have a little tiny bit of seed money, and I mean at the national lab, it's very tiny bits that are called laboratory-directed research and development dollars. And those dollars, the labs try to start these kinds of processes on, but they're very, very small amounts of dollars, and they just allow us to stick a pinky toe in and start to talk about stuff. But then that lets us hold bigger conversations with governmental agencies and business. It's a big problem to get the businesses. You need to understand big business is in business making money and is very, very shy of trying untested technologies, because, you know, it's like if you're in, if you were Timken Steel, you take a tube plant down, you're losing millions of dollars a day by having it down, and just to retrofit it with a new control system that you don't know will work when it goes back online, you're gambling, you know, thousands of people's jobs, and it's very hard. The power system's the same way. You know, people demand their power to be on, and if you're going to roll out new control systems on that power grid, where are you going to test it? How are you going to test it? Who wants to see their power go out because there's a software glitch? How many times has your computer program not worked and you needed that new patch for that program? So these are very, very hard issues to even if you had the technology and it was sitting right here on the table right today to roll that technology out is a real problem in the way we do business today.
You mentioned the research involved with the cyber-physical systems involves so many different disciplines. I'm wondering if it's, you know, to push boundaries in the fields of science and technology, that these multidiscipline efforts are important.
They are very important. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I'm here in South Dakota. You know, my managers and my mentors, the fellows at the National Lab, always thought I should go back to do some educational work. And when looking for universities, I could be at many, many universities, but I chose to come to South Dakota and the School of Mines because it does cross-disciplinary research. And it's one of the few places where the stovepipes aren't as big and as firm as many of the other universities in the country. So on a regular basis, I can walk over and propose things with my colleagues and do things that at normal universities are not normally done or taken on because we do a lot of cross-disciplinary research. I mean, my students like to laugh. You know, I sit in the electrical engineering department. I work with the AMP Center. I work with, I'm going to, you know, I have students in the biomedical engineering program. I'm going to have a student doing my PhD in MES this fall, and I will hold appointments in all of those fields. I hold an appointment in computer engineering as well. So, I mean, it's that kind of cross-disciplinary work that the School of Mines has been traditionally very strong in, and that's why we have cross-disciplinary programs like biomedical engineering, nanotechnology. And MES. These are cross-disciplinary things, and that's a rare thing at a university. Many universities say they have it, but we really do it.
So this is what this is how you approach the way you teach your students, this the multidisciplinary aspect.
Yeah, and it's in fact embedded all the way down to our undergrad level. You know, we have a lot of different students in. We have a new REU, a National Science Foundation research education undergrad experience. We have three of them at the School of Mines this summer. There's a number of them across the state. And in that, if you came to my lab, there's six students in my lab. Their backgrounds, just to give you an idea, you know, we're doing basic controls type research. I have two mathematicians, one physicist, a computer engineer, a master's degree student in electrical engineering who had his undergrad in computer science, and an electrical engineering student. So that's the kind of world we work in to do this kind of work, is we need these different disciplines. At the National Lab, it was kind of interesting. My group, we had two mechanical engineers, two metallurgical engineers, two mechanical engineers, two electrical engineers, a physicist, and a biologist to do welding research.
That almost, it sounds to me that the multidisciplinary approach is, even if it is important, just important in education, just sounds like that it would make it more interesting and more fun, if I can use that word.
It does. If you look at like our curriculum, we have our design curriculum for mechanical and electrical and computer engineering are fused. Sophomore design is made up of mechanicals, electricals, and computer engineers. You move on to mechatronics, which is made up of all three disciplines. You move on to senior design. Most of our senior design are cross-disciplinary across the whole university, pulling in even more disciplines. I mean, that's a trend, and it is very useful for students because, after all, when they leave the university, they will not be together. They will be in multidisciplinary groups. Name an object that doesn't have multiple disciplines in them. If you look, you know, you pick up your iPhone, you know, think of all the technologies that are in that. And the mechanical engineering is just as important as making that glass that doesn't scratch, right? And that's the material science. All of those aspects are in that product that you're picking up and using.
Well, Dr. Toll, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday.
Very happy to.
That's Dr. Charles Toll. He's an associate professor at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology and senior researcher at the Idaho National Laboratory. He and his teammates were recently recognized with the Special Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers Award for leadership in the development and advancement of research in the field of resilient cyber-physical systems. And he joined us from our studios at the Dahl Art Center in Rapid City.